Evening, Ben from Stanton, California.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Ben Favre. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Kyle for asking me to come out, Kyle coming with me. And Joe who had called me. He called me, asked me to come out, and then called me today. You know, did a good job, and then shows up and says, "Oh, now I remember you." And really made me feel like a champ. My sobriety date is January 12th of 2001. My sponsor is a gentleman by the name of Larry T. My home group is the Bellflower Big Book Group. I want to thank our 10-minute speaker. Did a really good job. Made me a little bit more nervous because she was on top of it. And I got to admit, tonight I do not feel on top of it. I got to Kyle's house. I was going to change into the suit and realized that I had gotten two totally different types of socks. You know, not black and blue, not a white one and a gray one or something. I've got circles, and I got squares. I mean, it's not looking good. I'm excited to be here tonight, and my life is truly amazing because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was born in Tacoma, Washington. My mom had me when she was 16 years old. She was either a moderate drinker or a heavy drinker, as our book describes. And when she had me, there was a sufficient enough reason for her to stop or moderate. And now she has a glass of wine on occasion, and it's no big deal for her. I remember my birthday was just last week, and we went to this restaurant, and she ordered this margarita, and she goes, "You mind if I drink?" And I go, "Doesn't matter to me, you know. Like, I'm not drinking. You're not making me drink, and drink up. Can I have some money?" It's no big deal for her, you know. She immediately, she has one margarita, and she gives the keys over. I mean, who does that? My real father's probably more the real alcoholic, and I actually spoke to him for the first time in a couple years this past week, and he's living the life that I'd be living, and he doesn't have a job, he's losing the house that he's in, he's not having a good time, and it was a reminder of what my life could be like, because I'd be exactly like that. As a kid, I grew up in Tacoma and Seattle area, and always felt really uncomfortable. I hated my name. I thought Ben was a wussy's name. It seemed to me everybody who was cooler than I was named Mike. So we played cops and robbers or cowboys and Indians, and I just call me Mike. Just call me Mike. They call me Mike for a little while, and they'd screw it up, and I'd get pissed off. When I was about 7 years old, my parents had another son, and they named him Mike. I always hated that little bastard, and that discomfort, it made me look outside myself to try and find something to make me feel better on the inside, and what you had always seemed like it was better than mine and would make me feel better, and I would see your hat and I'd think, if I got that hat, everything would be okay. I would get that hat or one like it. It'd fill up that hole for a short period of time, that hole would open up again, and then I would see that bike. If I could just get that bike, I'd be okay. I'd get that bike or one like it, fill up that hole for a short period of time, that hole would open up again. I'm creating this vicious cycle of trying to find something outside myself to make me feel better on the inside. When I was about 10 years old, my stepfather had a job opportunity to move down to California, and we're sitting at the dinner table, and he goes, "How'd you like to move down to California with us?" And as if I had a choice, and I'm a dreamy kid, and I'm thinking I'm going to be a guest appearance on The Simpsons. I'm going to be in some commercials. I'll be rich and famous. It's going to be great. I cannot wait to come down to California. And we moved to Huntington Beach, and it was 1994, and not realizing the geographics of Huntington Beach and Hollywood, not that close. Closer than Seattle, but still not that close. And it was 1994, and in the Pacific Northwest, the grunge scene was really popular, and my mom being young when she had me, I'm wearing ripped-up flannels and ripped-up jeans, and when you're in Washington, that's cool. Everybody looks like that's great. You move to Huntington Beach, and you're white trash, and it just... made me feel even more uncomfortable. And, you know, and I started getting into fights, and not that I'm any sort of tough guy, you know, as you clearly can see, I am not a tough guy, but, you know, you would make me feel uncomfortable, and I punch you in the face, and I run away. And sometimes you win, and sometimes you don't. And we moved a couple more times, and every time I would move, I would get back into the swing of things, start getting good grades, meet friends at school, and then we moved that last time, and I just kind of gave up. I said, "What's the use? What's the use of, you know, trying to do all this stuff?" And you know, and I just kind of gave up and became a class clown and messed around all the time. And you get friends like that too. You're just not the right kind. And I barely graduated junior high. Normally, you don't hear that. Normally, you hear I barely graduated college or I barely graduated high school. But I'm an overachiever when it comes to being a loser, and I barely graduated junior high. And that summer, I was at a friend's house, and all my friends had been drinking by this point, and they were. My friend Chris was there, and he's really excited to get me drunk for that first time. We're waiting for these 40s and Mickey's to show up, and these 40s and Mickey's finally show up around 10:50. I got to be home at 11, and you know, and we go outside, and I drink this 40 real fast, and I start skateboarding home, and I get this feeling like everything is going to be okay. This feeling like everything is in the right place. You know, the situations in my life didn't change. You know, nothing had changed. I just felt okay with where I was at. And, you know, and I was going to seek that feeling for the next few years and at any cost. And I didn't start drinking on a continuous basis right away. It took about 2 weeks, and I was drinking as often as I could. I went into high school, and I was barely attending class. And after the first semester, a counselor sat me down and said, "You know, you're going to have to go to an accelerated school to get the credits to graduate on time." And during that period of time, and by this time, drinking was already taking an important role in my life. And I was. At my aunt and uncle's house, and it was either Thanksgiving or Christmas. And my aunt says, "We'll pay for you to go to Mater Dei." And Mater Dei is a private Catholic school in Santa Ana, and people from all over the state will get recruited for their sporting programs, and go to colleges after that. And it's a great school, and I'm sitting there, I'm thinking about it. You know, I could get good grades. I'll go to any college I want to. I'll get a great job. I'll have a great life. You know, this is the start. You know, everything's going to be great. And I heard Catholic girls were easy. And but then that second thought is I'm going to have to stop drinking. And I don't want to have to stop drinking. So I said, "No, that's okay." And I went to independent studies, and I would go to school for a half hour a week. I get these little packets, and I would, they got a couple paragraphs above that and a couple questions. You know, it's real easy. You know, real easy stuff. You know, and I had it made. I had no problems. I was drinking and getting loaded as often as I possibly could. I kept everything real quiet. I knew that if I got into trouble that I was going to have to stop, so I kept everything really quiet. And I didn't have any problems for a couple years. You know, it was just me hanging around with my friends, you know, having fun. When I say having fun, maybe not your kind of fun, but, when you're, 13, 14, 15 years old, the fun you have is hanging out in a garage and drinking, that was fun, sometimes you venture out into, go back to the school that you no longer go to and, sleep in the quad or something. And that was our fun. But, after a while I started getting into a routine, and just like every good alcoholic, I think we get into some sort of routine. And my routine was I wait for my friend Jeff to get out of school. We had a couple Miller High Lifes, and we watched Dazed and Confused every day. And I started to think that if I went back to regular high school, it was going to be just like that. You know, if I went back to regular high school, I was going to join a sport. I'll get good grades. I'm going to get everything back together. I'll only drink on the weekends. It's going to be better. And if I can go back, that's what I'll do. And it'll be better than it is now. And that idea that normal living is the solution for my problem. That summer I was at a friend's house, and it was 4th of July, and I had started went a test run at back at high school and went to summer school. But that 4th of July I was at a friend's house, and I'd always stayed away from hallucinogens. I had a friend who was a couple years prior to this. had taken too much acid. He was walking around Westminster Boulevard butt naked, thinking he had pink spots all over him. And then we didn't see him for about 6 months, so I didn't really want any part of that. But for whatever reason, that night I decided I was going to take one hit, and I didn't think it was working, so I took 30-some-odd shots of various different types of booze. And that night I went home, and normally what I would do when I get home, you know, good night, Mom, go right to bed. And for whatever reason that night, I just wanted to chat. And I walk in the house, and hey, Mom, how's it going? And she goes, come here, you know, and she gets right in my face, and she goes, blow on my face. And I, you know, and she goes, you've been drinking, haven't you? And she takes me back over to my friend's house. And, you know, and by this point, my mom doesn't know any of the people I'm hanging around with. And you know, and the reason for that is because, and I'm sure some of you have moms like this as well, but she's the type of mom who likes to ask questions. And if you're hanging around the people I'm hanging around with, they don't know the answers to those questions. So you just, you keep them away. And but for whatever reason, that night I was drunk enough to tell her where I was, and we went back over to the house. And she opens up the door, and there's four or five of my friends standing down the stairwell, and my friend Pasquale is at the top, and she's yelling at him, he's never coming over here again. And apparently Pasquale had the balls of the group because he was the furthest away, and he goes, we don't care, get out of here, you know. And and my good friends, but I, you know, and that was basically, that was basically the beginning of the end. My first sponsor says that we drink for as long as we can, and then we drink for about 8 months after that. Yeah, so and that's basically what I did. All that happened was I started doing worse things in order to get what I needed. I'm sneaking out of the house. I'm stealing money from my parents. I'm stealing money from friends and stores and whatever I can steal. I'm getting my hands on it. And that summer, I went back up to Washington to visit my real father, and by this time, he's my drinking buddy. And we're drinking one night, and my grandmother hears that I've been drinking, and she comes over to my house, and she sits me down in her car, and she's crying, and she says, Ben, you're going to be just like your dad, you're going to be just like your grandfather. And those two people that I never wanted to be like, those people that I knew that it was alcohol that made them live the way that they were living, and I didn't want to be like that. And, you know, I'm not stupid. And I just said, all right, I'll stop. I'm not going to do it anymore. I promise. I won't do it anymore. And I get back home after a month or so, and my mom takes me to family counseling, and we're in this family counseling session for about a half hour. And I don't know what it is, but if you're non-alcoholic, I can convince you it's something they're doing that's making me act this way. And after about a half hour, the counselor looked at me and said, you know, what is it you need from your mom? And I go, well, she never buys me any clothes, you know. And the counselor looked at my mom and said, why don't you take him shopping? And we never went to any more family counseling sessions. And, you know, and like I said, I went back to regular high school, and, you know, and I was drinking enough that I was not capable of attending class. I don't know that I was detoxing or anything like that, but I would get to school in the morning, and I feel like everybody's staring at me. My skin is crawling. I just feel so uncomfortable that I would have to leave. And after a month or so, I got arrested. I go into this youth shelter. I'm in this youth shelter for a couple weeks, and I think maybe that's what I needed. Maybe I needed to be separated for a little while. Maybe, you know, now that I have 2 weeks not drinking, that now I can stay sober. And, you know, and I get out of that place, and I have that firm resolution not to drink again. I have this excitement that I'm not going to have to drink. I finally have escaped it. You know, I have that confidence that I'm not going to do it. And, you know, and I go to my class, and I see my friend Jeff in the hallway, and he goes, you want to get out of here? You know, and that confidence immediately said, no, I'm not going to drink. And he goes, Tim just got a bottle of Jack Daniels and a new bong. And just like that, I went, all right, I'll start tomorrow. You know, tomorrow I'll start, you know. And every day after that was, I'll start tomorrow. I cannot do it today. Can't possibly do it today, but I can do it tomorrow. And another month or two go by, and I get home one day, and my mom and I get into an argument, and I don't know what it was, but after 20 minutes of arguing, I just said, I can't stop drinking. And I didn't want, I wanted to stop. I didn't want to drink anymore. And I was getting to the point of not understanding how to, you know, I was terrified. And she said, all right, we'll get you some help. And she puts me to this outpatient treatment center. And I'm in this outpatient treatment center for a couple weeks. And, you know, every day I'm, And even though I don't want to drink, even though I want to stop drinking, when the idea that you're taking alcohol away from me, it makes me want it even more. And after a couple of weeks, they said my drug alcohol level was higher than when I come in. And either I needed to stop or I needed to leave. And I knew I wasn't going to be able to stop. And I got out of that. I left that place that night. I stole some money from my family. I ran away from home. I'm staying in my friend's shed behind his house. I'm for the next month or so, I'm drinking a fifth of Jack Daniels every day. And after a few weeks, a month or so, it was 3 days before Christmas, I black out, and I come to walking out of a Hollywood Video around 11 o'clock at night, and the buzzers are going off. Apparently, I decided I wanted a movie, and I was new to the situation, so I just kind of kept walking and thinking maybe they didn't notice. Two people came outside and pulled me back in, and not violently or anything. I mean, they just grabbed my arm, and I went, okay, I'll go back in. You know, because I had no more fight. There's no more fight. They took me down to the Westminster Police Department. Well, the police picked me up and took me down there. And my mom comes to pick me up. I haven't seen her in a few weeks by this point. And I get into her car, and she says, "Ben, I can't do this anymore. If you want to live your life like that, you're going to have to do it somewhere else." You know, I'm the oldest of seven, and you know, there's all these, and they're much younger than me, and you know, and I'm doing all this crap around them, she said, you know, every time I hear the phone ring, I think the cops got you. Every time I hear sirens, I think you're dead in the gutter somewhere. I'm terrified of the day that I'm going to have to identify your body, and I never wanted to make my mom feel like that. I never wanted to treat her that way. You know, I as a kid, I would tell her, "I'm going to buy you a house on the beach. I'm going to do all these things for you." I have nothing but love and respect for my mom. I genuinely wanted to do those things. You know, I meant it with every fiber in me. And you know, and for whatever reason, you know, in that situation, any normal person, any person with a conscience whatsoever would say, "I'm sorry, that I've done this to you." But in that situation, I'm not willing to look at my part. I'm not willing to look at the things I'm doing, and I laughed at her and treated her like she was stupid. And the next morning, I got into a fist fight with my stepfather. There was a restraining order over Christmas. I was staying at my friend Jeff's house, and Christmas morning, my mom calls me around 9 a.m., and she says, "Why don't you come over and have some breakfast with me and open some presents?" And you know, and I had every intention of saying thank you and being a good kid and having a good morning with her. And and I go over to their house, and either she says something I didn't want to hear or I didn't get what I wanted, and I started breaking things in her house and pushing her around. And she hung up the phone and called the police, and the police seemed like they were there in seconds, and they just said, "Get the hell out of here, kid. You don't belong here." You know, and I left there, and I went to this grocery store, and I stole two tall boys of Mickey's, and I just wanted to recapture that first drink. I wanted to take that sigh of relief. I wanted that feeling like everything was going to be okay. And for whatever reason, it didn't do what I needed it to do that morning. And, you know, I stayed at that bottom for another couple weeks, and social services stepped in and said that either they were going to take me away or I had to be placed in a long-term treatment center. And I went into this youth shelter, I'm going to go into this long-term treatment center, and I left that youth shelter on January 11th, and the next morning I was going into that treatment center, and then that night I was going to gather some things and then just go in the next morning. And I just told my mom, you know, I actually asked her, "Do you mind if I go say goodbye to friends?" And you know, and she said, "Yes, that's fine." And actually, I was truly surprised that she had said yes. And a few years later, I actually asked her, why did you say yes that night? And she said that if I said no, you would leave anyways and probably not come back. But if I said yes, maybe you would. And you know, and that's the type of that's the place that we put our the people we love in there, in that emotional state. And you know, and the next morning I woke up, I went to this treatment center, and that was my sobriety date, and I didn't think it was going to be my sobriety date. You know, how am I supposed to stay sober? I was 16 going on 17, and, you know, how am I supposed to stay sober for you know, all this time? And, I thought that, I'm going to be here for 5 months, and I'm going to get out of this place, and I'm going to go back, and it's going to be just like it was. It's going to be, I'm going to get everybody off my back and get everything going and good again, and it's going to be just like it was. They started taking me to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and during that period of time, I had started reading the book, and I had a hard time relating and a hard time understanding what they were talking about, they started telling me to get a sponsor while I was in there, and I asked a couple guys, and I asked this guy, and he said, I have too many. I don't have enough time for you. Why don't you ask him and ask that other guy? He says, I just got my kids back. I don't have enough time for you. And I just kind of gave up, and I didn't ask anybody else for about a month. I was about a month and a half sober, and I'm talking to this lady, Patty, and this guy is leaving there, and I'm telling her I can't find a sponsor. And she goes, why don't you ask that guy right there? And this guy, Andy, was leaving there. And I walk outside, and Andy's probably 6 inches shorter than me, and he was standing 2 steps below me, but for whatever reason, he felt taller than me that night. And he had this look in his eyes, he had this glow in his eyes I knew I didn't have. I said, hey, would you be my sponsor? And he didn't give me one of these lines, why don't you meet me here? Why don't you call me for the next couple of weeks, and we'll see how it works out. Why don't you read this and get back to me? He said, are you willing to go to any length for victory over alcohol? And I was tired of the way I was feeling. I was tired of the way I was living. And I said, I'll do whatever you want me to do. And he started taking me through the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We didn't dissect it. But we would read it. Every once in a while, he would ask me questions. He was very plain about it. He was just, hey, did you ever do this? He would talk about him, and I started to relate and started to understand what they were talking about, the doctor's opinion of Bill's story, he had me identify the classification of alcoholic I was, and at the time I thought that I was the manic depressive type whom a whole chapter could be written, and I just wanted a whole chapter written about me, but later on, I realized that I was the psychopath, and I hate the way that it sounds, but I'm always going on the wagon for keeps. I make many resolutions, but never any decisions. And that's the, I'll start tomorrow. We started reading Bill's story, I remember reading Bill's story by myself and thinking, I don't even know what the hell a ticker is. I don't get it. How can I relate to this? And I started to realize that I related to Bill a lot more. I wasn't stealing from my wife's purse. I was stealing from my mom's purse. No, I wasn't not taking an opportunity for this job. I was not taking the opportunity for a school. No, I wasn't a golfer. I was a skateboarder and a punk rock kid. I realized that I related, a lot to what Bill had gone through and the choices that he made. I kept working those steps, and I got kicked out of that treatment center when I was about 5 and a half months sober, and I couldn't stay away from the girls or smoking when I wasn't supposed to smoke. Once again, I'm in this fork in the road. Either I'm going away until I'm 18 to Arizona, or I'm going to go into the sober living house, and my sponsor and the counselor at that treatment center convinced my mom to put me in this sober living house, and I'm now 17 years old, And all I wanted to do was go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had heard enough in that 5 and a half months that I knew that Alcoholics Anonymous was where I needed to be. People that I met over that period of time just started picking me up and taking me to meetings. One guy would every Wednesday night, one guy would drive from South Orange County all the way up to Orange. Drive me all the way back to South Orange County for a meeting. Drive all the way back to Orange to drop me off. Go all the way back home to South Orange County. 45 minutes each way. He was spending 3 hours a day just to pick me up and take me to a meeting. I'm truly grateful for that, because if it wasn't for that commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous that these guys had, I wouldn't be sober today. They were active and on fire for AA, and they just wanted to see me stay sober because they had heard my story. I kept working those steps, and I got to the eighth and the ninth step, and I had heard some kind of goofy things in the meetings that I was going to, and one of those things was that I had harmed myself the most, so I needed to make amends to me, and I did this eighth step, and I'm writing out all these amends, and I put myself at the top, and I tell my sponsor about it, and he goes, what are you doing on the list? And I go, well, I hurt myself the most. He goes, I don't know where you get this crap, but you can put yourself on the bottom of the list. After you make amends to the rest of these people, you can make amends to yourself all you want. He goes, and I have no idea what you think you're going to do to yourself to make amends, but... So he had me put my mom at the top of the list because I had harmed her the most, and he had me write this letter to her, and I wrote out this letter, and he goes, all right, now go to her house and read it to her, and don't say anything that's not on it because I don't want you to screw this thing up, and I go over to her house and I read it to her, and at the end of the letter it said something to the effect of, if there's anything I can do to make these things right, please let me know. And she had seen enough of a change in me in that past 6.5-7 months that she just said, keep doing Alcoholics Anonymous to the best of your ability. And that's exactly what I've done. I've not always done it perfectly. I've made plenty of mistakes. You know, I'm not saying that I've done this thing perfectly. You know, but the thing is I've been willing to make those mistakes right when I make them. And I made a couple more amends, and I was amazed before I was halfway through and didn't make any more amends for another couple of years. When I was about a year and a half sober, I started having this thing in the back of my head saying, maybe it was a phase, maybe it was this, maybe it was that, maybe you're too young, maybe you can drink normally now. I go to this Wednesday night meeting that I've been going to that whole time, and this older gentleman sits down next to me, and he goes, aren't you a little too young to be here? And I go, you don't know me, you son of a bitch. I didn't really say that. I probably said something really witty like, no, you know, but I went home and I grabbed the book and I was going to find something to throw in his face, and I'm going through there and I got my little highlighter out and it starts talking about young people, and I'm like, here it is, this is it, you know, and it says, there are those of us who only drank for a few years that were in the same position as those of us who drank for 20 years. I thought, holy crap, that's me. I'm like, here it is, this is it, and I keep underlining, and it says, this is particularly true of the woman alcoholic, so won't be bringing that one up anytime soon, but for whatever reason, that was all I needed. There was no more debate. There was nothing in the back of my head saying maybe it was a phase, maybe it was this, maybe it was that. I knew that I was just as every bit of alcoholic as everybody sitting in these rooms. I'd realized that I was sitting in these rooms for the previous year and a half, relating to things that you guys had been talking about, you know, and they've been different, may have been different situations. You may have been, you know, older or well, be hard to be younger, but you were most likely older or much older. I started to realize that I was an alcoholic, and there was no more debate. You know, I caught fire for Alcoholics Anonymous after that, and it seemed like every September for the first like 5 years, I would go through something that was very difficult, and I would learn something big. When I was 2.5 years sober, there was this guy Keon that I would follow around every once in a while, you love hearing him share. He's this type of guy where you love hearing him share. You go to the meetings that he goes to, but you don't talk to him, because he might ask you about what you're doing, you know, and you don't want to talk about that. You just want to hear what spiritual jewel he has that night and go home and feel good about it, you know. But he corners me that weekend, I'm telling him all my problems, and he says, you know, once I started making financial amends, my financial life got better, and once I started making relationship amends, my relationships got better, and I want everyone to love me, and I want to be rich. So I went out and I made 30 amends that week, you know. I didn't have the money the week before, and I couldn't find some of these people the week before. All of a sudden, they were popping up, and the money was there. I got fired up about it. You know, I got these lists. I got the grocery stores, liquor stores, 7-Elevens, some police officers, some old friends, you know, some teachers, whatever. And I'm working the 7-Elevens one day, and there's 4 or 5 7-Elevens up and down Westminster Boulevard, and the first 3 or 4 I walked into, and the amends had gone well, And the one guy goes, man, I've never had anybody do this before. Thank you so much. I go into the last one, I've got a little confidence now. You know, I've said my little pitch a few times. You know, I'm feeling good about it. I wait for the line to die down. I got $10 in my hand, and I go, 2.5 years ago, I stole 2 packs of cigarettes, and in order for me to stay sober, I need to make every wrong I made right. I probably said it just that fast. But he goes, oh, you want 2 packs of cigarettes? I go, No. I stole two packs of cigarettes, and I need to pay you back. And he goes, what? You stole from my store? Get out of here. I was like, you want your money? I'm a little freaked out, and I'm kind of frozen there. And I look behind me, and this guy's standing there, and he goes, don't worry about it. You did your part. It's like, holy crap, you bastards are everywhere. And and I left there, and I got into my little car, and I'm getting onto the freeway, and I don't know if it had been the last 2.5 years being sober. I don't know if it had been the commitments that I had been doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know if it was the guys that I were sponsoring at the time, the amends that I had been making, but I got this overwhelming feeling like everything was going to be okay. This overwhelming feeling like everything was in the right place. That very same feeling that I had found in alcohol, that I'd been seeking in alcohol, I got here in Alcoholics Anonymous by doing the things that you guys had suggested. And I continue to try and get that feeling everywhere I go. You know, and I don't get that feeling by thinking about me or doing things for me. I get that feeling by thinking about you and doing things for you. And caught fire for AA and started sponsoring a bunch of guys, and I had joined some young people's committee since I was young, and I always hated it. I just hated it, but I went anyways. It talks about it, and I think the 12 and 12, and it talks about how our ego kind of rebuilds or whatever. And I started painting myself into a corner in AA, and I started judging everybody, and you're not doing it the way you're supposed to be doing it. You should be doing it the way I tell you, And I started making myself really uncomfortable. And during that period of time, the girl I'd been dating for a couple years had broken up with me, because I'm judging everybody else, I don't want anybody to see my crap, and it made it even worse. And, after a couple of weeks, I got arrested, for threatening my life and others. And, get out of this car, and, a police officer pulls me over. I get out of the car and all of a sudden, realize, this is real life. I need to relax here. And he goes, would you like it to be harming others or harming yourself? And I go, what do you mean? He goes, would you like to go to jail or would you like to go to the hospital? I'll take the hospital. Hospital will be good. So he took me to the hospital, and I realized that what I had been doing all that time. I've been judging all these people, and because of all that judgment that I had, I couldn't face, having made a mistake. I couldn't face, my life seemingly not being perfect. And I got back involved in AA, and I shut my mouth for a little while, I had a lot of wreckage to clean up during that period of time. And I just went on my merry way. A couple months later, I started working at this job, and we get back, in AA, we try and get back with our families and mend those relationships, I had mended the relationship with my mom pretty well, but I always hated my little brothers and sisters, because I was 7 when they were, when the first one was born. They're much younger than me, so they're much cuter than I am, and I always hated them for that. But my youngest brother was probably 4 or 5 at the time, his name's Simon. And I would go to my parents' house every day for lunch, getting a free lunch, and this kid Simon grabs this book one day and he slaps it on my lap and he goes, read. And I go, all right, and sit him down and read to him, and he starts doing this every day, and after a couple months, I'm getting excited, lunchtime, going to go read to Simon. And I go over one day, and I read to him, and I start to leave to go back to work. And he runs up to the door, and he locks it, and runs up and grabs my leg and says, you can't leave. And that's the very same door that I was standing in front of when that police officer told me that I didn't belong there. And I get to have those types of experience because I'm thinking about other people, and I feel that feeling like everything is in the right place. And I when a couple years go by, and um, I uh, I'm on Accupaw at the time, and this was 2008, and this girl that had broken up with me, I hated her for that entire 5 years. Not like, disliked or was just intolerant of. I hated her, and she hated me. And, when you don't naturally just hate somebody for 5 years. You know, there's some stuff there, you know. And we're on this committee, and we're outreaching and all this stuff, and I ask a bunch of people to come with me out to Palm Springs. I'm speaking at a meeting out there, and or outreach for Accupaw, and she's the only one who shows up, and she gets in the car, and we go out there, and it was like meeting somebody different, and I'm sure she felt the same, and we're on our way home, and I had a good time, and I go, if I ask you something, and you disagree, can you promise not to tell anybody? I've even been sober for a while. You understand, we like talking about each other, I just kind of don't want that stuff out there. But she says yes, and we start dating, and a little over 3 years ago, I married her, and that's really is the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, because had that happened outside of AA, I would at least hope that people wouldn't get back together. Actually, I just thought about that. It was really sick, actually. About a year and a half go by, and we decided that we were going to try and have a baby, and she decided she's not going to take her birth control, and all of her friends say it's going to take 6 to 9 months before you get pregnant. And I'm planning it out. Okay, we're going to buy a house in about a year. So the baby will be born about a year and a half after the 6 to 9 month period. Well, she gets pregnant a month after she stops taking it, and immediately I'm thinking I'm dying. I am dying. This life is over, and I just feel really uncomfortable. I got to get the money situation right. I got to get these things right. I was not prepared, I tell my close friends, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I'm going to love this kid. I don't know how am I going to do this? And everybody who had a kid would go, man, once you see that baby look at you, you're going to fall in love. And I go, full of shit. you're just saying that. You're just saying that to, make you feel better. October 27th of last year, that baby was born, and everything they told me was true. And I love that little girl, I started thinking about when I was a kid, and my mom did the best that she could with what she had, and I truly love her for that, all I want to do is give that kid the best life that I possibly can, and I can only do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And during that period of time, like I said, I kind of got obsessed with the money things and all that, and bought a house, and had this great job, and started thinking, look at this life that I've created, and thinking that type of stuff, being happy with the material things was going to, make me stay sober. I want to stay sober if I have those things, this is very, very not true, but I was at this meeting, and this kid got up there, and he was given 10 minutes, and he said something you hear, all the time. All the time. He goes, it's not the big things that get you drunk, it's the little things that get you drunk. I realized it was like hit me like a ton of bricks. So I realized it's not the big things that are going to keep me sober. It's the little things that I continue to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not the having the nice car. It's not having the house, the wife, the children. It's not having, graduating from college. It's not doing any of those things. None of those things are going to keep me sober. They're nice. They're nice to have, and I hope I get to keep them. Probably won't. Probably going to, be back and forth. But, it's not those things that keep me sober. It's the little things that I continue to do in AA. You know, the fact that I show up on my regular meetings and sit in the regular seat that I usually sit in, and unless of course somebody else is there. We've got problems with that at Monday night. You know, you get there early and think you're going to save a seat. It's somebody else's seat. You find your stuff all the way in the back. But I don't do that, I promise. it's about doing those little things and my little commitments and my showing up on a regular basis. You know, I'm 14 years sober and I still go to four to five meetings every week. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I continue to do those things, I get to live happy. I get to be happy with the things that I have. And a little over a month ago, the Seahawks lost, so I quit my job. I had been thinking about and considering going out and starting my own company. And I just kept feeling like, you know, I was scared, terrified. Is this my ego? Is this what is this? And I finally came to the conclusion that if I didn't do it, then I was going to regret it for the rest of my life. And I got everything in order and quit my job and started a little company. And it's terrifying. Yeah, it is literally terrifying. It's been a little over a month it's very uncomfortable not getting a regular paycheck or having somebody there to tell me what to do. You know, it seemed like it would be easier. You know, and everybody, all my friends who own their own companies or work for themselves would tell me, you know, it's the hardest thing you're ever going to do in your life. And I go, oh yeah, sure. They were right. But even though there's a lot of that fear, I continue to go to my meetings and I get that little break and I know that if I continue to do Alcoholics Anonymous, even if this business thing doesn't work out, my life is going to be fine. My financial security may fall apart. Certain things may happen that make things a little bit more difficult. But if I stay active and participate in Alcoholics Anonymous, my life is going to be fine. When I was new, there was this guy. What, 2 minutes? All right. There was this guy at this Wednesday night meeting that I would go to, and his name was Chuck. And I would see him every week, and I'd go, "How you doing, Chuck?" He'd go, "Better than I deserve." And I'd go, "Okay." And next week I'd go up to him, "How you doing, Chuck?" "Better than I deserve." And "How you doing, kid?" "Well, not as good as I deserve, you know." So a side note, my sponsor says that he doesn't want to be anywhere near me when I get what I deserve. But I go up to that guy Chuck the next week and "How you doing, Chuck?" And you go, "Better than I deserve." I go, "What do you mean? You've been sober, you know, over 25 years. You sponsor all these guys. You have this great life. Why don't you deserve the life you have?" And he said, "For all the bad things I've done, mistakes I've made, people I've hurt, I don't deserve the life I have today." You know, I can say that truly for myself. My life is better than I deserve. Thank you.